Richard Rhodes is the serious, popular, go-to analyst of nuclear weapons for most of 30 years now, ever since he published his acclaimed History of the Manhattan Project and the mostly men and science and the political emergency behind it all. His first masterpiece was called The Making of the Atomic Bomb. Since then, Arsenals of Folly, most recently, The Twilight of the Bombs. Richard Rhodes also wrote a play about the Reykjavik summit between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, perhaps the closest we've been so far to the complete abolition of nuclear weapons. I asked him, how can we get back to a nuclear-free world?
In his book Slaughterhouse 5, his novel, Kurt Vonnegut has this vision of running the film of the Second World War backwards so that the explosions coalesce into a dropping bomb, which falls upward into the bomb bay of the bomber, which flies backwards to its base where the bomb is removed from the bomb bay and disassembled, and the materials that made the weapon are turned back into the original ore and buried deep in the ground. In a sense, that's the way you would eliminate nuclear weapons from the world, by moving them, first of all, off hair trigger alert, and then perhaps by removing the warheads from their missiles and physically separating the two things so that it would take a number of hours to put them back together. And if you keep thinking of that and walking it back, you end up with parts of nuclear warheads in a warehouse somewhere, or perhaps in different warehouses, different pieces. But it also means that there's a certain finite amount of time necessary before they can put them back together and actually deliver them. Ultimately, you end up with a world, ideally, where it would perhaps take 6 months to remanufacture nuclear warheads, during which time the nations that are in conflict would have a chance to look at other solutions to their conflict short of nuclear war.
Richard Rhodes, from the beginning of your history of the making of the atomic bomb, there were nuclear scientists who thought that the bombs would never be used, but that the knowledge of the destructiveness of this technology was the key thing. What would it take to convert these thousands of weapons we still have into, shall we say, the mere knowledge of the power they represent?
Deterrence operates at the crudest possible level of my walking into a room where there are a bunch of people with guns, and I'm wearing a explosive belt around the middle with a detonator in my hand. And I say, if you shoot me, I'll push this button and we'll all blow up. Well, yeah, that probably works. It doesn't seem to me like a very satisfying way to protect the population by threatening to kill us all. And indeed, as the arsenals have increased in destructive force over the decades, we are now at a level where even a small regional nuclear war has been pretty well demonstrated by simulations to have as its logical consequence the deaths of several billion people from mass starvation because of the world-scale climatic effects of even a 100 nuclear weapons exploded between India and Pakistan, burning down cities, putting smoke into the atmosphere. We would be much better off slowly reducing our arsenals down to zero and stockpiling enough material in a warehouse somewhere. You know, I've envisioned a world where the knowledge is what protects us. There's some old rusty warheads in a warehouse somewhere, kind of like the stacks of cannonballs on those forts along the U.S.-Canadian border that we visit because we're curious about what a strange world it must have been when the U.S. and Canada were threatening each other with grapeshot and cannonade across the river. That would be a nice place to be, and we would have a little time before we went back to the warehouses and put the bombs back together and returned us to today. We would have a little time to think about the real consequences of whatever the dispute is that we might be having with whatever country it is.
If we did get rid of the last atomic bomb, the last nuclear weapon, there would still be the knowledge. Is that consoling or disturbing?
I mean, there's no question but that the knowledge has given us a world without world-scale war. If you look at a graph of man-made deaths from war starting in the 18th century, it goes up almost exponentially until 1943, which was 15 million deaths in 1 year between the Holocaust and the Second World War. And then in 1945, it abruptly drops down from about 15 million deaths to about 1 or 2 million per year, and it stays there for the rest of the period from 1945 to today. Now, 1 or 2 million deaths from war and war's attendant privation is nothing to be proud of as a species. But we lose more people than that every year from smoking. So we have come to a deep and radical change in the history of the world as a result, I believe, of the fact that world scale war is no longer is too dangerous to happen anymore. We have a new kind of knowledge in the world as a result of this very extraordinary process called science. And we're still trying to come to grips with it. It seemed at the outset to be something that would give us more national power. It's a very hard lesson to learn that in fact it has drained away the kind of belligerent national power that gave us two world wars and about 120 million dead in the 20th century from those wars. It's a hard lesson to learn that we have reached a point where we don't have to even worry about those wars anymore, but can indeed move on and explore this new territory. It was, I think, Robert Oppenheimer who said in one of his speeches right after the Second World War, he said, the atomic bomb was the turn of the screw. It has taken us up to a new path through the mountains, and beyond there is a new country. We're in that new country now. We haven't quite realized it yet. We think we're still sort of stuck on the other side. But we have to figure out now the human institutions that will parallel and support and maintain the knowledge that science has given us about how the world really works when you really want to release a lot of energy. And in fact, I think if you look at a number that was first promoted by the director of the CIA back in the mid-90s, which is how many nations in the world could develop a nuclear arsenal if they decided to do so today. That number approaches 40 nations. And that means not only the obvious ones that we think have been looking at that possibility, but all of the countries of Western Europe, Mexico, Canada, Japan, obviously, South Korea, which was on the nuclear path several times in the second half of the Cold War, and the United States leaned very hard on it not to continue along that path. So there are lots of countries that could go nuclear. In fact, the majority of potential nuclear powers are nuclear powers only at the level of knowledge today.
That's a fascinating point. You say roughly 40 countries could have them if they wanted. Only 8 do.
Exactly.
30 plus have decided, thanks but no thanks. What does that tell you? And where is it a way to begin, you know, a further process?
Well, I think it tells you that nuclear weapons, far from being the aggrandizement of national power that people like Winston Churchill hoped they would be back in 1945, in fact, are liabilities, especially for smaller countries. I spoke several years ago with some of the scientists in Sweden who had worked on a Swedish bomb back in the early 1950s, and they explained to me that when there were only fission weapons, relatively low yield compared to the kind of big hydrogen bombs we would build later, when there were only fission weapons in the world, they thought, well, we should build a few. And then if the Russians ever try to attack us with a fleet of tanks coming across Northern Europe, we would be able to hold them off with our nuclear arsenal and they would back away. But they said, I said, so why did you decide not to build weapons? And they said, well, once the thermonuclears, once the hydrogen bomb came along, we realized that it would only take one or two to destroy our entire country. And we certainly didn't want to have a little fission arsenal around that would provoke the Soviets into doing something like that. So we gave up that idea. So there's lots of precedent. In fact, the precedent is very much in the direction of countries seeing nuclear weapons as a liability rather than an asset, leaving us with the question of why the eight nuclear powers, formerly nine, maintain a nuclear arsenal. And mostly the answer is prestige. I mean, Great Britain has debated now for a number of years whether it should continue to maintain its rather small couple hundred warheads nuclear arsenal. And it constantly falls back on, well, nobody would talk to us anymore, which is, you know, when India went nuclear in 1998, the Indian defense minister was quoted as saying, well, now the big boys are going to have to let us sit down at the table with them. That's a pretty bad argument for being a nuclear power, when by becoming a nuclear power, you put your nation at risk from all the other nuclear powers.
They say drug dealers know this logic too. If they carry weapons onto the street, they have more heft in a way, but they're also targets. I also like this image that every nuclear power is, in a sense, a suicide bomber with an activated belt.
And that's where we've been now for long enough that I think we're seeing a generational change in the way younger people think about nuclear weapons. In fact, many Americans, perhaps many people around the world, think that we've already gotten rid of our nuclear weapons, which, you know, sounds ignorant, but it's rather logical. Why did we have all those weapons? Well, we were told we had them because the Soviet Union was threatening us with such an arsenal. If that was the case, then why do we still have them? Who's threatening us now? Nobody. In fact, we are down to, there's a wonderful line that Colin Powell said back in the late 1990s when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that I think is as true today as it was then. He said, I'm running out of enemies. I'm down to, let's see, what was his list? I'm down to Saddam Hussein and Kim Il-sung. Well, Saddam is gone. Rest in peace. Kim Il-sung is now replaced by a somewhat belligerent grandson of his who has a small arsenal, but obviously understands, as his grandfather did, that any possible move in the direction of using that arsenal would mean his country would be immediately obliterated by nuclear weapons from the United States or elsewhere.
Can I interrupt you right there? I mean, Elaine Scarry's book reminds me of another trend entirely. These Ohio-class submarines, eight of them at least, commissioned since the end of the Cold War, that have many, many, many multiples of Hiroshima destructive power in each one. And there's also the note there, you say H.W. Bush was dismantling a great part of the arsenal. George W. Bush, in Elaine's book, has issued these highly secret or unpublic orders to modernize the Minutemen, modernize the Trident missiles, sort of well into the middle of this century.
Well, this is domestic politics. Every time a president has presented a treaty to the Senate for ratification, the price of that agreement has always been the so-called modernization business. Most recently, it was President Obama with the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which the senator from Arizona, Kyle, held out for an $80 billion modernization, so-called, of our nuclear weapons research and production complex. He got his $80 billion from President Obama, but President Obama did not get his treaty ratified. So I think you have to put all that over on the side of domestic politics. understand what an incredible waste of money it is, except to line the pockets of large corporations, and realize that it doesn't make us any safer at all. In fact, it simply perpetuates a world where we're at great risk from our own weapons and from the weapons of other countries that see us maintaining a large-scale nuclear capability and assume that there must be good reasons why we do so beyond the vicissitudes of domestic politics. This is the real tragedy, I think, of the nuclear arms race from the point of view of our nation. And it's why, as much as I deeply admire Elaine Scarry and her work, I don't think that her idea that somehow the people of America will rise up and put down this situation has much chance of a realistic future. The doctrine of deterrence from strategic bombing, the rationale for our bombing Germany and Japan during the Second World War, was that if we bombed them enough, the people would rise up and overthrow their belligerent governments and sue for peace. That was as unrealistic, I think, as the idea that the people of the United States, as divided as we are over such a simple thing as whether you're going to own a personal weapon or not, the likelihood of our contentious politics resulting in agreement that we're going to all get together and convince Congress to go back to the old way of declaring war, I think is not very great, I'm sorry to say. That's why I think the better way is to go around the politics of this country, get the rest of the world moving toward increasing agreement that nuclear weapons have no place in the world, and then bring the United States in at a later stage in the process.
That's so interesting. It's a little depressing that we become the slow learners in the neighborhood. Her notion, though, is that national defense, self-defense, like taxation and representation, ought to be pretty widely distributed, that there's more common sense out there than there could be at the top. But let me put it to you in general. What would it take in the way of distributed knowledge of nuclear destruction to get us to a sane place in the world, meaning a world of virtual deterrence just on the basis of common knowledge of what we're talking about?
Well, let's look historically at the last time the United States population was in favor of some sort of world peace. And that was in the years immediately after the Second World War. What did it take to get us there? It took the deaths of more than 600,000 Americans and 52 to 55 million people around the world in the most destructive war in human history before we were prepared to sit down and talk about things like world government, the United Nations, international control of atomic energy. And even then, those concerns were very quickly buried under a sweeping fear of the Soviet Union, which I think followed directly from the test, the first Soviet nuclear weapons test in August of 1949. The real Cold War came on when the Soviets tested their first atomic bomb, because they had still 3 or 4 million men on the ground in Europe. And as long as we had the bomb and they only had conventional forces in Europe, we had felt secure. But then they got the bomb, and suddenly they had those 3 or 4 million men on the ground and the bomb, and we panicked. I mean, the history of what happened in Washington in 1949, the decision to go for the hydrogen bomb, which was a very bad decision from the point of view of the United States, because we have a lot of big cities and the Soviet Union did not. Therefore, a bomb that was basically a city buster was very much to their advantage, but not to ours. We would have been much better off staying with smaller bombs, which is what Robert Oppenheimer argued at that time, and it's why he had his security clearance taken away and was publicly humiliated. So we had a chance once before to go that route. And for whatever reasons of national insecurity or national belligerence or a feeling that somehow you really got to pile up the weapons before you can be safe, it doesn't seem to be in our particular mentality to feel that we should be the first ones to move toward a safer place with fewer weapons.
Richard Rhodes, you say our own domestic politics and psychology makes us probably the last to give these things up. Turn it around. Who out there is in a position to lead?
Well, I think we've been seeing various countries leading all along. I mean, most of the countries around England, Australia and others that were part of the old British Empire have moved in that direction. The Scandinavian countries never did build their bombs, although they could have, Sweden. The countries that have voluntarily foregone developing a nuclear arsenal, which totals up, as we said, 35 to 40 countries. The countries that have signed the nuclear free zone treaties around the world, which is quite a large number of countries. There is an active participatory movement. The countries that are part of the nuclear test ban treaty, which is more than 150 countries, I mean, we're really down to a small number of miscreants, which includes the United States, Russia, China, Israel, France, Great Britain.
Who would you bet on to be the first one to peel off of the eight?
I think Britain is the likeliest country to go next. It's been an active subject of discussion and debate, and it's an expense that England doesn't need. They're down to just a couple of nuclear submarines at this point. Their conservative government recently decided to build a new nuclear submarine fleet, but a small one. I think that the only reason they cling to a nuclear arsenal is because they're concerned that they won't be the big boys at the table without it. The same thing is true with France.
Richard Rhodes, this is so extraordinarily helpful and interesting. Thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for your epic studies of nuclear weapons.
Thank you very much.